Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Well, before we get started, this is how many questions came in from you guys out there. Thank you very much for these. Okay, so thank you, Stacy, and good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. My guests today are two of the greatest theater and film titans of all time, Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart. Their massive careers span half a century. Between them, they have played some of Shakespeare's greatest roles, including Macbeth, Hamlet, Prospero, Othello, King Lear, and Richard III. They are both members of the Royal Shakespeare Company. On film, you only have to mention their roles: Gandalf, Professor X, Magneto, Captain Jean-Luc Picard, for such films as, yes, let's hear it. For such films as Lord of the Rings, X-Men, Star Trek, and The Hobbit. They have both been knighted by the Queen for their services to drama. They are both actively devoted to charity work, helping countless numbers of people. Ian, for his support of gay rights and co-founding the organization Stonewall. And Patrick, for domestic abuse protection with the organization Refuge. And post-traumatic stress disorder through the organization Combat Stress. Well, now they are back on Broadway, mesmerizing audiences and critics alike in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot and Harold Pinter's No Man's Land, which they are playing, yes, playing in repertory. Opposite Billy Crudup and Shuler Hensley, directed by Sean Mathias. Please welcome Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart.
Welcome.
You know, it's the same at the curtain call. We come on after Godot and do a little bit of a dance, and I come on from the wing, and as I come on, I look for the first time during the evening at the audience, and they are all looking at you. Same just now.
There is a little barbed remark in that which I need to clarify for you. When I look at the audience for the first time, what Ian is saying in code is, Patrick looks at the audience all the time.
Yes, he does.
Because I'm the one who says who's out front and how big the audience is and how attractive some of the boys and girls are that are sitting there.
Well, first off...
Oh, you're right, yes.
Right? Look at this. Welcome back to Broadway. How does it feel?
We love it here.
I first came in 1967 with a play that I'd been doing with Judy Dench for over a year in London. She didn't want to come to America, so Eileen Atkins came in her stead. Ian McShane was the other member of the cast. We were picketed by American Equity because the entire cast was British, three of us. It was a play set in Russia. At the time of the Cold War, it was vaguely pro-Russian because the characters were sympathetic. America couldn't take it. We lasted for 27 performances. And ever since then, I've been hoping to have a hit on Broadway, and maybe this time we've finally got there.
It's happened. 1970 or 71, a production from the Royal Shakespeare Company of Midsummer Night's Dream, which has become known as the Brook Dream or the White Box Dream. And we were a smash hit.
We were.
Plus, I think we
How
were...
How things change.
I think we may have been the only show that transferred from Broadway to BAM and not the other way around.
Well, I know that BAM is one of your favorite theaters because both of you play there.
The Harvey, certainly, yeah. Yes. It's a magical theater.
I think I must hold some sort of record. I've been in three separate productions of King Lear at Brooklyn Academy of Music. once with the Actors Company, which is a company that I helped to found in the early 70s, in which the actors ran the whole enterprise. We were our own managers, we employed our directors, etc. We all got paid the same, we shared the fun of being number one dressing room if we were on tour, and I played Edgar in that. And then I came back with the National Theatre production with Brian Cox as King Lear, and I played Kent. And then more recently with the Royal Shakespeare Company production, directed by Chevenon, I played King Lear. So I feel very at home at BAM.
And of course you did Macbeth there.
Yes, following the Brook Dream.
Yeah.
But we did that in the Opera House, which was challenging.
Yeah.
It's a big space.
Sure. Well, before we get into No Man's Land and Waiting for Godot, we wanted to find out how many people in the room have seen the productions already. Raise your hands. Clap. Well, a lot of you have. Okay. So, Waiting for Godot and No Man's Land are two of the finest evenings or matinees anyone will ever spend in the theater.
Oh.
The two of you are obviously having the time of your lives. What has made this so special for both of you?
Well, it has no precedent for me. Now, Ian has run companies before and has experience of being a company leader and a producer. I have not. And it may not be known to you, I think it is known to you, that along with Stuart Thompson, Ian and myself and our director are the producers of this show. And also, significantly, investors, which is breaking 101, never invest in your own shows. But we have done. And so... and that came about because the creative spur for this event came from the three of us. And having had the idea of doing Godot and No Man's Land, and then with the same four actors and alternating the performances, having come up with the idea, we felt we didn't want to give it away to someone else. That, wouldn't it be fun if we were in control of it? Well, it's largely been fun. and it's largely been exhausting because we are continually attending meetings and, you know, planning meetings and so forth. But that has been, I think, for me, the most exciting part, coupled with an opportunity to do No Man's Land, which I've been waiting to do for nearly 35 years.
And Ian, for you, because it started with doing Waiting for Godot, and you had the best time doing that in London, didn't you?
We did. It was a very successful production that I seemed to change people's view on the play. They found it much more accessible than they had in the past. I'm not sure that was anything to do with us. We just did the play as we saw it, and the audiences respond. Maybe the world's grown up around Godot, which was initially thought to have been extremely difficult. Obscure play and stories of the first production in the English, in your country and in ours, is of seats banging and audiences leaving at the intermission, uninterested in what happened next. Well, that really has totally changed. And I had such a wonderful time and hoped we might revive it. And I'd thought we'd hoped to come, I think, to New York when we were first doing it, but there was another production on here, Tony Page's production with Nathan Lane and Bill Irwin, John Goodman. So the, Broadway didn't need two Godots. When the chance came to do it again, I leapt at it, and we do have this love affair with New York. I mean, I wouldn't live anywhere else or work basically anywhere else than in London, because I'm very familiar with it, and there's so much work there in comparison with New York. I mean, there are big subsidized companies, and as well as the commercial theater in the West End, and lots of other places where you can put on plays. So there's a lot going on. It's a good place for an actor to be. But a hit on Broadway and the New York sense, or Manhattan sense, that theater is almost defines New York. Make it there, you'll make it anywhere. That sort of spirit, is inside us as performers. Then we had the cheeky idea of doing two plays at once. And as producers, that's where we came up with our first problem, because we unlike the recent productions from the Globe Theatre in London, which came here with Mark Rylance, Richard III, and Twelfth Night, those productions were all done and dusted. They were ready. They just transferred them over. We had to start from scratch. We had two wonderful American actors, which we very much wanted to have. We didn't want to be an import. We were a Broadway production. We had long rehearsal periods. We did No Man's Land in Berkeley, California, to run it in 5 weeks there. That was very expensive for our production. So we've learned quite a lot about how not to put on shows. But I must say, hand on heart, that this job, and we're nearing the end of it now, has been perhaps the best time I've ever had in the theatre. And it's because it's worked with the audiences, and both players are relished by us all. So I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Patrick, the same?
Yes, very much so. We came out of a repertory system, and we were accustomed to doing. There was one season with the RSC. I was in five plays, and all five plays would at some point be performed every week. So there was nothing unusual in thinking of doing two plays in a week. What is unusual is doing it in a commercial house on Broadway. But for us, it's delicious, because the performances can never, and will never, in the remaining 8-9 weeks, become stale, because we're always refreshing. And I think accompanied by the way in which the five of us work, that includes Sean Mathias, our director, making something as fresh, spontaneous, and immediate as possible every single moment of every night has been the driving force of both productions. But then all of a sudden, hello, it's 7 o'clock on a Wednesday evening and we're doing No Man's Land after four performances of Waiting for Godot. And the plays are very different in their setting and style, while at the same time in content and themes, they overlap perpetually.
Yeah, you're actually a perfect foursome up there, because you're also playing with Billy Crudup and Shula Hensley. And you have one of the finest directors in Sean Mathias. And Patrick, you had mentioned something backstage that I had told him, and I had seen like 16 productions of Waiting for Godot, and I've never truly understood the play until this production, the clarity of it all. And you told me that for the first few weeks. Tell us, you sat around a table read, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we had 6 or 7 weeks total rehearsal. And the first two and a half weeks of that rehearsal period was spent in a room sitting around a table. We never got on our feet. And the principle, which is becoming increasingly a principle, I find with directors of a certain age in the UK, is that we read and read and read and discuss and discuss, not in an analytical way of what does this mean, what does it symbolize, but rather the most often asked question would be, what is going on? Who are these people? And good old acting 101, what do they want? And by the time we got on our feet, I think we were pretty clear in our heads who we were and why we were there, what our backstory was, and what our hopes were. Is that right? Mm.
Yes, I think so. I was asleep during most of the process. I mean, it's a stop. After the shows, we meet any of the audience who've waited in 48th Street to say hello to us. And the number of people who studied Waiting for Godot at school, I mean, ordinary high school, it astonishes me. I mean, what crackpot educationalists thought? I know what would be good for the boys and girls. They should read Waiting for Godot. Well, they should not read Waiting for Godot any more than you should read a Mozart off the page. You listen to Mozart, and you listen to Godot. You listen to any play. You're an audience. Audio. You can't do it yourself. And witness the fact that it took us 2 or 3 weeks. And we're trained to read scripts and still find it difficult. But it takes us 2 or 3 weeks to begin to lift the words off the page. So why should someone in high school, led through by a teacher, expect to get anywhere with it? And that's, I think, perhaps why they're enjoying the show so much, that they celebrate, oh, I see, it's an entertainment, is it? It's a play. There's lights, there's music. Yeah. Patrick Stewart sings. Dances after a fashion. But you know what I mean.
You have also made these plays very affordable to see, and that's very important. I'm sure it was important to you two to have that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
But though Ian must take the credit because he argued for it from the very beginning, as probably at some point this afternoon you might hear him argue the importance of equity and being a member of equity. Mm. This is something dear to Ian's heart, and I was only too happy to sign up for all of his ideas. Yeah. Tell us what they were.
In the Olivier... in the Olivier Theatre, at the National Theatre Complex on the South Bank, named after the great actor who was the first director of the National Theatre, Sir Laurence Olivier, when they were designing the auditorium, he said, I want the front rows to be for the groundlings, named after the people who in Elizabethan theatre would stand round the edge of the stage to see Shakespeare's plays and his contemporaries. And so if you ever go to the Olivia Theatre, go down to the front and you discover that those seats are indeed cheaper, but you have to pay. There are no armrests. You're all in there together. Olivier thought the audience should be slightly uncomfortable if they hadn't, if they hadn't paid the full price. But that's the same with us. If you're happy to wait in the cold and get your day ticket, it'll be $30 and you'll be on the front row and the best seat in the house. And for students, I
well, I wanted to.
And those are the people who are all looking at Patrick Stewart when I come on at the curtain.
It's so untrue. If they're looking at anybody, believe me, they're looking at Billy Crudup. And let's face it, he is worth looking at.
He certainly is.
Well, I want to go back to the beginning. Growing up, where did your love for performing begin, and what were your early creative outlets?
My fate was sealed, I suppose, when my sister took me to see an amateur production of Macbeth, shortly followed by one of Twelfth Night. I must have been about 8. I was taken to other events that might have captured my imagination, like football matches and cricket matches and opera, actually, and a little bit of ballet. I don't know what it was about those plays in that particular setting. I was riveted as an audience. And that's where I began as an actor, as an audience. And I still am an audience. I love going to the theatre. Can't get enough of it. Constantly hoping to be excited, desperately unhappy if I'm not, but always hoping. And waiting. And it wasn't until quite a lot later that I realized that I could enhance my enjoyment of the theatre as an audience by getting involved in putting on a play and discovering how it was done. I'd seen so many plays. How do they do that? Why do they do that? What's going on there? And the way to find out was by acting myself, and I started to do it. But just to drone on a little bit longer, I suppose it's the first time that you bump into professionals that you begin to wonder, could you be one of them? And the first professional performers I saw were not actually actors, but they were vaudeville people. We had what was called a variety theatre in our town in the north of England, where each week groups of entertainers, professional entertainers, would arrive. Dog acts, singers, dancers, magicians, and this sort of carry-on. And I was allowed to go backstage because my father knew the owner of the theatre. So at 14 and 15 and 16, every Thursday, I went backstage. And I saw it was twice nightly, they did the same bill twice. I stood in the wings and watched these performers touring the country for very little money. God knows what their digs were like that they were staying in. They were probably all drunk. The backstage conditions, were foul. But there was I standing in the dust, surrounded by the hempen ropes which moved the simple scenery, and seeing them trudging towards the stage, exhausted and tired with the day and not much looking forward to the performance. And as the music started, stepping out across that line into the light, transformed, and transforming possibly the lives of the audience who were watching. And whenever I go backstage, doesn't matter whether I'm in the theatre or visiting it, I sort of look for that. Where is that line that you step out of the dark into the light? And I thought, I've got to be one of these people. Well, I feel a great kinship for vaudeville people, and I think there's nothing braver as a performer than being a stand-up comic. But you know, when you play Hamlet, you better be ready with the tricks that stand-ups use of galvanizing the audience's attention and making them wait for your next word and hoping they might even reply, to be or not to be. That's the question, wouldn't you say? Don't you agree? Have you got an answer? So it's all connected. And I am still excited by the memory and to be able to relive it. It's wonderful. So, there we go. You've heard all that before.
No,
have you not?
No. Heard none of that backstage stuff before, for the first time. This is why these events can be so delightful for us, and we've spent a lot of time talking side by side, and yet I'm hearing something brand new. Maybe he just makes it all up.
After all, he's an actor.
No, I'm an actor, I'm not a writer.
I have one person to thank for everything, and I talked to him on the phone just a few weeks ago. He is 96, was my English teacher in a very, very non-academic school. Very non-academic. Are you leaving?
No.
And this was the man at the age of 12 who put a copy of Shakespeare, distributed copies of Merchant of Venice around the classroom. Remember, this was a school where children came in Wellington boots without socks all year round. 12. And he said, he cast the trial scene. And he said, all right, read it. And so we all began to ourselves. Of course, we thought we had to read it. And he said, no, this is a play, it's not a book.
Yes.
Read it out loud. And for the first time ever, I spoke Shakespeare out loud. And for a reason I cannot fathom, I had an immediate instinct for it. And feeling for it and love for it, even though much of it I didn't understand. And not much later, this same English teacher put me in a play with adults, playing a small part of a schoolboy in the play. And the first time that I walked onto the school hall stage, which is where this drama club performed, in rehearsal, I experienced a feeling I'd never had before. And you must understand, this is years of expensive California therapy that has helped me to understand. Coupled with brooding on it anyway, I felt safe for the first time in my life. And when the first performance came along and I walked onto a brightly lit stage with 200 people sitting in our school hall, that sense of safety was even stronger. Not danger or risk, which is what it's supposed to feel like. My childhood had been chaotic and at times dangerous. But here was certainty, security, predictability for 2 or 3 hours.
And I think that's true of a lot of actors. Mm-hmm. I think it's why a lot of actors, at least in the past, have been gay. The only place they could express themselves and be themselves at a time when it was illegal, certainly in my country, to be homosexual, was in public and protected by the play. And you could come up with real emotions for a real situation, but it wasn't, of course, your own. Because there's nothing more dangerous, is there, than standing up in a brightly lit place. Who knows what loon might be out there with with what projectile? I mean, yeah. It doesn't bear thinking about. But overriding that fear is your, I bet, your escape from some things in your home life into a place where they didn't apply. And
plus, becoming someone else.
Yes. Well, same thing, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
Because the gentleman you were talking about, is it Cecil Dormand?
Yes.
Cecil Dormand, yeah.
He is. Let's applaud Cecil Dormand.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always that one person that takes you as a person and sets you on your path.
And often, if you go around the green room at the Royal Shakespeare Company and say to the company, who was the first influence? English teacher, again and again and again.
Frank Green.
Yes? Frank Green for you. So what was that defining moment? Do you remember the defining moment where you said, I'm going to do this for a career. I have to be an actor. This is when I'm going to do this.
Sitting in the office of the editor of my local newspaper, a weekly newspaper, where against all the odds I had been given a job, the two of us started on that newspaper on the same day. Myself, at the age of 15 and 1 week old, having finished the minimum education that the state insisted on, and the other one was a Cambridge graduate. it didn't work out for me, largely because I was involved with so much amateur theatricals. By the time I was 15, I was at one point rehearsing with 6 different companies in my local town. We were, everybody performed in my town. And he sat me down and he said, things are not working out, largely because you're never available and you're never here. And you're making up copy that isn't true. And you're having people phoning reports into you and then you're writing them up and they're full of inaccuracies. And it will not do. So either you decide you're going to be a newspaper reporter and you give up all this amateur theatricals, or you get off my paper. And I thanked him and I left his office and I went upstairs to the reporter's room, packed up my ancient Remington and walked out with a couple of friends on the paper who had been very kind to me, saying, no, no, don't do that. This is a terrible mistake. And I went home and told my parents I was going to be an actor.
And what did they say to you?
They said, ooh, love, are you sure? What they didn't tell me, because nobody had told me, because it was a story that was not told in my family, was that my grandfather was an actor. And not a nice guy. He abandoned my father and his 3 siblings, perhaps 4 siblings, and their mother, and disappeared we think, to come to the United States. Almost certainly he came to, in fact, we know he came to the United States. And the last time he was heard of in London, he was appearing at the Elephant and Castle Theatre, which is now gone. It was destroyed in the Blitz during the war. And two policemen came to the stage door to arrest him for non-payment of support to my mother and to my father's mother and the children. And my grandfather persuaded the two policemen to let him finish the play he was doing. He had one more scene to do. He asked them to wait in the wings until he'd done his scene, and then he would come with them. They agreed to this. He went on stage, played his scene, and exited the other side. And was never seen or heard of again. So when I said, I want to be an actor, it was something of a shock to my
And Ian, for you, that defining moment.
Yes, I know exactly where it was. Every time I'm in Cambridge in England, I visit it. Flagstone outside the stage door of the Arts Theatre, the Professional Theatre. I was an undergraduate in an undergraduate production of Henry the Fourth, Part Two, directed by John Barton, who shortly after has left academia to go and help Peter Hall run the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford. Derek Jacobi was Prince Hal, and I was playing Justice Shallow, very old man, in a big pointy hat and a long beard.
Hang on a minute.
And I slavishly copied every note, every inflection, every tone of voice that John Barton gave me. I mean, he gave me the entire performance, and I just copied him. And was rewarded with a wonderful review in a national newspaper that came. It's my favorite review of all, because we didn't have our names in the programs. It was just gentlemen putting on plays. You don't want to advertise yourself. And the critics said, we'd like to know the name of this actor because it would clearly be a name to remember. Well, you know, at 21, crazy about the theatre, with no ambitions to be an actor at all because I'd seen the great actors. I knew I wasn't up to it. But then this man sits in the paper. And a friend said to me at the stage door on this little paving stone, I can still go and stand, and he said, so are you going to get yourself an agent? I said, what? Well, he said, after that review, you'll be able to get an agent and become a professional actor. And I said, great.
Do you remember Richard who Cotton. The reviewer was?
Yes, Alan Dent. He was James Agate's boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I wrote and thanked him.
Yeah.
You see, I've never heard that.
See? This is what you find out in conversations. During your careers, both of you have had major breakthroughs in your approach to acting. Ian, I believe your approach to acting changed in 1976 when you were appearing with Judi Dench.
Yes.
In that Trevor Nunn production of Macbeth, changed everything for you, didn't it?
Yes.
Would you tell us about that?
I was very proud when I started out of being able to play to an audience this size, if not larger, in those large provincial theatres that we love, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where we saw some of our first good theatre, and touring round those dates and filling the house, which I'd done as Richard II and Hamlet and Edward II and then other plays as well, that was my pride. If you sat up there and you'd only paid 5 shillings, you're going to get the performance. People down here were a bit bewildered as to what the hell I was doing, you know, because I was. I was shouting and just different. And of course, that is a problem. How do you do it? How do we play to you at the back there? And you see my arms going out to you now in order to try and touch you. When really, for you down here, all we do have to do, we can just talk like this and they don't know what's going on. So it is a problem, isn't it? Acting in the space, it's the first thing you have to deal with. Where are we going to do the play? Anyway, I thought I'd solved it at the big theatres. And then, one day, we come to do Macbeth in a theatre that's only got 100 people sitting around a magic circle. 12 actors. And no intermission. And everything concentrated. And the possibility of speaking the lines at a conversational level. Because what, unfortunately, what can happen is if you're projecting up there, you might start selecting what you want those people to hear, as opposed to just being and let them do the selecting. You see what I mean? In the other place at Stratford, the revelation to me was that it was so much more rewarding being inside the play and the audience almost inside it with us. And ever since, really, I've only ever wanted to work in small theatres, which then led me on, when I was lucky enough to be asked to be in films, I was sort of getting ready for that because that's the smallest audience of all, the closest audience of all, the camera. Mm-hmm. Gets far too close often. It gets closer than your lover could get to you. And that's very, can be difficult. So that was it. And thereafter, my aim as an actor came to be not to just impress the people back there, but to utterly convince the people along here that I was the person I was pretending to be.
Yeah. And Patrick, for you, I believe it was The Winter's Tale and also a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at the Old Vic? Were they both turning points sort of for you? Would you explain?
I've been doing quite well in the RSC, working my way up, like other actors, some you will have heard of, like Roger Rees and Ben Kingsley, who were spear carriers in their first season. I mean, literally. They didn't have any lines to speak. And one season I was asked to play Henry IV and Leontes in The Winter's Tale. I read The Winter's Tale and I didn't care for what I read. I didn't care for the character, and my instinct was at once to turn it down and to look for something else in the season. And then very soon after that, I ran into Dame Peggy Ashcroft, our great leading lady of that time, who said to me, "Oh no, my dear, don't play Leontes. It's a loathsome role. No actor living has ever enjoyed playing that role." And told me stories about John Gielgud and others who had played it. And so I went to meet with the director, wonderful man called Ronald Eyre, and said, "I'm sorry, Ron, this is not for me." And he asked me why, and I said, "He's such a beastly, unsympathetic, ghastly individual. There's no redeeming features in him, except maybe in the dying moments of the play." He said, "You're right. He's a horrendous individual, violent, cruel, bloody-minded, deceitful, dishonest, cruel to friends, all of that. But he said, "You see, I think all of these qualities are already inside you. You don't have to act them."
Ooh.
And the only way that any way you would pull this off would be if you would be willing to let those out. Nobody had asked me to do that before. And we talked about this for a long time. I should also add that Ronald Eyre, apart from being a brilliant director, was also a psychologist. And he said, "If you will trust me and find all of these qualities inside yourself, and through Shakespeare's brilliant language, release them on an audience, I will," and this always moves me, he said, "I will always be at your side. And you will never fall, I promise you." Well, of course, I said yes, didn't I? And it was true. And an American friend of mine, a Shakespeare scholar at UCLA, saw the production 3 or 4 times and said to me after the 4th time, "You know, Patrick, you would have had more success in this role," which speaks volumes, "if sitting out there we had felt that what was going on was far too private for public consumption." But after that, there was no turning back. I couldn't. I was probably one of those last breed of English actors who became very clever at faking it, at pretending. Well, after The Winter's Tale, I couldn't fake it anymore. It has to be, for me, the real thing.
And the greatest speech in that play, and I'm one of the few people who loved playing Leontes. I'm not saying I was any good, but I loved it. But particularly that speech, "Too hot, too hot." when he turns on the audience and talks about his wife and his best friend in the vilest terms, and makes jokes about them, and makes jokes about sex, and makes jokes about the possibility that the audience is actually groping each other as he's speaking to them. You look it up. It's the most amazing speech. And the best person to probably get away with it without a great deal of rehearsal would be a stand-up comic with a filthy mind.
Well, since we have
It's horrible, isn't it, that speech? I mean, you hate yourself for saying it, don't you?
Yes, and what do you recall the impact that had on the audience?
They were very uncomfortable.
Yes, yeah, very uncomfortable. Even, doesn't he say, even now?
Yeah, now.
Even now while I'm talking, while I'm saying
smile, so smile, your neighbor.
I know what you're doing. Yeah. I know what you're thinking. It's, yeah. I mean, and this is 400 years old text.
Yeah.
Since we have so many drama students here today, you have each played many of Shakespeare's greatest roles. Which has been the easiest role for each of you to grab hold of, and which has been your hardest challenge?
Simplest part in Shakespeare is Iago.
Why is that?
Wow. Wow. Well, Iago is the guy in the play Othello who brings down destruction on his boss and his boss's marriage and many of the people surrounding because he is the most jealous character in the play, and I could talk about it for hours, but he does the most dreadful, dreadful things, but everybody in the play keeps saying of Iago, what a wonderful man he is. Honest Iago. Kind Iago. Thank you, Iago. What would I do without Iago? And then when they've gone off stage, he turns to the audience and says, fools. And so you become complicit with his lying. So all you have to do as Iago is not play a nasty man, but play a very nice man. And the story does the rest. You don't, there's no problem, Iago. But you will see Iagos who think it is a difficult part, and whilst they're being nice to everybody, they keep turning to the audience and saying, no, I'm not really nice at all. Well, that's difficult to do and stupid to do, and you don't have to do it. So there we are. That's, and the most difficult part?
Yes.
I'll think about that while you say something.
I want to ask you, am I too old to play Iago now?
You think? No.
I know, be frank, be honest.
No.
Okay.
Would you want to see him play that?
He's played Othello.
Yes, but...
A white Othello.
Yes, a white Othello. Became known as the photo-negative Othello because... Well, for the simple reason that all the other roles were played by African-American actors, except for the servants to Desdemona's father and the prostitute was played by a white actress. So both
Bianca,
socially...
But she's called Bianca.
She's called Bianca, yes.
She should be white.
Yeah. Yes, of course. but racially and societally, everything was turned around. It was one of the grandest, most emotional and beautiful experiences of my life. Thanks entirely to the Shakespeare Theatre in Washington, D.C., who were the only people who agreed to put it on. I hawked that production around England and here in the United States. And Michael Caine. I met him... I'm sorry, I'm suffering from a lot of catarrh at the moment. It's the weather. Michael Caine met me in an American Airlines departure lounge. He was already picking up his bags to leave and said, why don't you come and do something with us? And I said, I'd love to. And he said, is this something you really want to do? And I said, yes, I want to play Othello. And he said, oh, no. And I said, no, listen, 2 minutes. I pitched my idea and he said, when are you free? And that was it.
So was he the easiest for you?
No, that was very, very, very difficult. The easiest actually was, they're both quite recent roles, and I played them both in the same season at Chichester. I played Malvolio in Twelfth Night, and same season I played Macbeth, which came here to New York. And one night in the Macbeth dressing room, because we were all, it was, as Ian was saying earlier about his experiences, we were, all the men were in one room, all the actresses were in another room. And we were fooling around saying, have you noticed not one of us in this production of Macbeth has a Scottish accent? So just for jokes, we began running scenes in broad Scottish accents. And then it was Mickey Feast said, you know, that would work for Malvolio, which we were due to start rehearsing the next week. Next morning, Saturday morning, I got up and I did what I never do in advance, but I read Malvolio outlined in a Scottish accent, and the role was solved, instantly solved. Everything hinged around that accent. And that was kind of easy, but the most exciting and challenging was without doubt the Scottish play. I loved every single minute of it. We closed at the Lyceum Theater here in New York 365 days after the first preview in Chichester. So it was a year basically of Macbeth, and it nearly finished me off, but it was every moment absolutely memorable. Yeah. And I saw it. I mean, I saw this Macbeth that Ian has talked about with Dame Judy, and it was absolutely terrifying, because all they had was a black circle painted on the floor and apple boxes. And the cast sat around on the apple boxes. And when you were inside the circle, you were on. When you were out of the circle, you were off. Is that right? I worked like that. It was phenomenal.
There was a priest used to come. I say used to. He saw it three times. It was a hot ticket, but he sat in the front row with his crucifix out like this.
Oh, you're nuts.
And I said to him after the show, what are you doing? He said, I'm protecting you from all the evil you're conjuring up. And that is not why Macbeth is considered to be an unlucky play. I have a theory which I pass on occasions like this, you might be interested in. Had you heard that it's an unlucky play? Some actors will simply not say the word or the character or quote it and rap each other over the knuckles if they do backstage. In the days when there were touring companies of actors with a repertoire of plays, Macbeth, being the shortest play by Shakespeare and the most thrilling, was the most popular with the audiences. It's still true. And so if you heard in the middle of the week that the management was going to slip in a couple of performances of Macbeth at the end of the week, it meant that they didn't have, at the moment, enough money in the coffers to pay you at the end of the week. So don't even mention Macbeth. Otherwise, we mightn't be getting money on a Friday night. The most difficult part I remember playing was Romeo. It's a pill of a part. I mean, if you had the choice, just play Juliet. And Juliet is the leading part. And if the play were called Juliet and Romeo, I don't think you'd get people queuing up to play Romeo. I would actually say the same of Cleopatra and Antony, which, but here I'm sitting next to a great Antony, so, and you wouldn't agree with me there, but I mean, Juliet is the part. Romeo, I found extremely difficult. I was too old to play it. I was 38. In fact, I was playing the same season I was doing Macbeth. I used to do Romeo in the afternoon and Macbeth in the evening. Yeah, but this was the fun of it, wasn't it? And the next day I was doing.
I suppose it was, yes.
And the next day I was doing Leontes. I was doing the three together. But Romeo, you can only play a part like that if, oh, somehow you totally inhabit it or it inhabits you. I don't know what it is. But I was so concerned to get the rhythms of that early Shakespeare right. So aware of the responsibility of making the audience fall in love with you, because if they don't, they're not going to care. And so I was showing off like billio and didn't relax into it. And it took me a good 6 months to get into that part. That's the luxury of these companies. So few of them around. You go and you start playing Romeo at the beginning of the season. By the end of the season, 100 performances later, you might begin to know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And then you can go on the road with it and tour it or bring it to the States. Took me a long time, but Romeo, I still squirm at my performance.
Well, you squirm unnecessarily, because I saw that, and it was wonderful. And it had in it the most electrifying moment. It was not quite your moment, actually, though you shared it. But I've ever seen on stage, Francesca Annis was playing Juliet. And in the tomb scene, when she is dead, lying on the catafalque, and Romeo comes to you, and he's going to... does he drink the poison too, or does he stab himself? Both, I think, is it?
He drinks the poison.
Yes. Well, just before that moment arrived, Juliet made the first movements of coming out of the drug, and we all saw it, and he didn't see it. And I mean, I swear the night I was in, there might have been people saying, "Look behind you! She's moving." And why was it so potent? It was a shocking moment, but it was because the audience were completely inside the scene. It was terrific, Ian. It was absolutely
well,
terrific.
Well, that was... that moment was not ours. It was stolen.
And as often, many of the great moments in Shakespeare proved to have been stolen.
That's right. During the rehearsals, Rudolf Nureyev, the Russian dancer, was dancing Romeo. And I wish I could tell you who was his Juliet. I mean, I did see Margot Fonteyn, his great partner, but I think this was another production. However, at the end, Juliet's arm, on the instruction of Nureyev, who'd choreographed it, went up as he was dying. And Trevor Nunn and I, our director of our show, we were watching this together, and we both looked at each other and said,
It is true, you know. There is something about working at Stratford and playing these plays and that you become often in an uncomfortable way, but mostly in a pleasant way, aware that you are standing in a long line that goes back generations. In that town, back to Garrick, who, am I right? It was Garrick who created the Shakespeare Festival. And I remember when I was in a production of Hamlet, and Ian Richardson, the king had taken off his sword to pray and put it down. And Hamlet came on to say, "Now might I do it, Pat, now while he's praying," picked up the sword to use Claudius's own sword, then decided not to do it and walked off with the sword. So that when Claudius was gone. Ian said he had seen somebody else do it, and that's why he copied it. When I played Malvolio, there was one piece of business I know I would put in. I'm so sorry about this, because I'd seen the great Ian Holm do it. In the cross-gartering scene, when he's made an ass of himself and Olivia has gone off, Ian untied the cross-gartering, let it all slip down, and massages his calves, because the cross-gartering had been hurting him. And then he hears Sir Toby and Andrew and Mariah coming. So he has to do them up quickly, and he ties them up and goes to make a dignified exit, which proved to be... because he had tied his legs together. And I couldn't do this in my production, but in the one that Ian was in, he made it across the stage like this. and then was faced with a flight of five steps. It was wonderful. I'm sure this business gets handed down, yeah. You know.
Generation after generation. Yes. You have both received numerous awards and accolades for your triumphant one-man shows. Ian, you for acting Shakespeare, and Patrick, you for A Christmas Carol. Let's hear for both of them. What has given each of you the most joy and satisfaction with these two shows?
Well, mine was stand-up. I was doing stand-up. I was coming to play Salieri in Peter Schaffer's Amadeus, and one of the challenges of that part is that the whole play is told through his memory of his life with Mozart, and he talks to the audience incessantly. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to New York, I'm going to pretend to be an 18th century Italian in a town that knows about what it is to be Italian, and I'm going to have to talk to them all evening long. I better get some experience of this talking to an audience, and that's, so I decided to, I put together a one-man show and took it around to a lot of foreign countries where they didn't speak English in Europe. And at the end of that, I thought, oh, I can deal with playing Salieri now in New York. That's why I did. What was the most rewarding thing about it? Oh, God, I had a wonderful time in that show. I did it over about 15 years in all sorts of places. That's the thing about them. You know, one actor in a chair,
yeah.
You can do it anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did. I did it in schoolrooms, in lecture halls, in big theaters, small theaters.
You know, the Rose Bruford School in London has at least had, I was an external examiner there for a number of years, and part of the course was that every final year student had to create not one, but two solo shows.
Really?
Which would then be marked, towards his diploma or degree, whatever he got at the end. But it's a wonderful idea because it meant that every graduating student had got two shows already under his belt that he could pull out and perform if he had to.
And yep. Patrick, you for A Christmas Carol.
Yes. It gestated over such a long period, from being asked to do a reading in my parish church back in the small town I grew up in for the Organ Restoration Fund. And I had not known what to do, except that I was filming in Derbyshire, and one morning waiting to be called on the set, sitting in my hotel, and it was raining outside, and I knew they were outdoors, and it was ghastly. I took down the thinnest volume in the hotel bookshelf, which proved to be A Christmas Carol, and I thought, oh Lord, I know this story. So I turned the pages and found, of course, I had never read it, and I read it through the morning, with my soup at lunchtime, finished it in the afternoon, weeping hopelessly at the end of it, unaware of the great power of the story. So then I read it in my parish church and didn't cut it enough, and people sat on hard wooden pews for 3 hours while I droned on reading this thing. But I thought, wow, there's something in this. So then it developed into a read performance, and then finally into a learned performance, and four times on Broadway and twice in the West End. I think it was introducing people to a version of A Christmas Carol that they probably had never seen before, with all its harshness and cruelty and social divisions and selfishness and greed. It's not just poor old
Scrooge.
Scrooge, thank you.
Did Dickens do it?
Dickens did it. He read it as he read a number of other cut versions of his plays. He did it here in New York.
Novels.
Pardon? Novels. But he did write plays too, because he was a great amateur actor,
yes,
and ran his own amateur theatrical company. His doctors told him that if he did not stop reading Bill Sykes' murder of Nancy, he would kill himself. And indeed, that's pretty much what happened. He refused to stop reading it. When he read The Death of Nancy, they had stationed in the halls St. John's ambulance or first aid people because so many men and women passed out, collapsed at the graphic intensity of his reading of that. Wouldn't you have given something to have seen
him? Yes, absolutely.
Well, we have to get into some of your film work. The two of you have been connected to some of the most successful film franchises and roles in the history of cinema. Star Trek, X-Men, The Lord of the Rings, and The Hobbit. Was it easy to say yes to the first X-Men film, and did either of you have any trepidations?
Said no.
Why?
Because it was some years after, what was that other show? Star Trek had finished. And I had not long come out of a director's office, a director I had been passionate to meet, to pitch myself for a quite nice supporting role in a movie, and had a lovely meeting with him, but it ended up with him saying to me, but tell me, why would I want Captain Picard in my movie? Yeah. And when I was told, I said, no, I've got one glorious albatross around my neck. I don't need two. I'm sorry, but thank you, I won't. And, but I agreed to have lunch with Bryan Singer, and I said yes,
because
he persuaded me that it was going to be a different experience altogether, and it was.
Sure.
Yeah, but I said
Ian,
no.
For you.
And what was the ask?
Did you have any trepidation in saying yes?
Yeah.
You had worked with Brian before at After Pupil. That
I was pretty. Film. I was pretty keen later in my career, have some decent parts in films. And none of that wouldn't have happened unless I'd made a film of my own, really, Richard III, which I adapted from
Brilliant.
The stage production. And, you know, that sort of proved that I could be trusted in front of a camera, which I think people had doubted before because I was busy playing to the people over there. Bryan Singer, who had just done The Usual Suspects, Great Acclaim, asked to see me, having seen my film of Richard III, in which I played a sort of Nazi version. And he was casting a Nazi in Apt Pupil, that we did with Brad Renfro. And as I sat down, he said, I thought you were older than you. Oh, you're too young to play the part. Oh, what a pity, he's an old man. I said, that one's fine, don't worry. And we started to talk about this and that. He said, have you seen John Schlesinger's latest movie, Cold Comfort Farm? I said, yes, I have seen it. Oh, it's great, isn't it? Yes, I thought it was great, yes. He said, who's the old guy who plays the preacher in that? I said, that was me. He said, you can play old. Yeah. So he cast me in Apt Pupil. And having done that, he then said he's going to do, he discovered these comics which he'd never read before. A friend of DeSanto introduced him to him. And he sold it entirely to me. Not that I had any snobbery about doing a comic. I mean, I've got very Catholic tastes in storytelling. You know, it can be anything. I don't, because something's popular doesn't mean to say it's not any good. And he said, the dilemma that mutants find themselves in an alien society is mirrored by the dilemma that goes right through the civil rights movement, which is, what do you do if society rejects you? Do you, with Magneto and Malcolm X, pick up arms and challenge society violently if necessary, or do you, as Martin Luther King would advise and Professor X,
stand up for your rights and try and fit in and to help society by being yourself and integrate. Well, having just been involved in the gay rights movement in the UK, I knew about this dilemma, and I'm firmly on the side of Professor X. And he said, Marvel said that the demographic for the comics, and I wonder if it's true of the films, the readers are young blacks, young Jews, and young gays, and they think of themselves as mutants because they've been taught that they're mutants. So it was a political act, really, that I got involved in X-Men. As for Gandalf, you know, anybody can play Gandalf. There's no big deal. I love being Gandalf. I love playing Gandalf. I'm very grateful to Peter Jackson and everything about all that. My life has been changed totally because of it. But I can't take really much more credit than saying, all right, I will sit here for 40 minutes while you stick on the beard, which is the put on the nose, put on the wig, put on the hat, give yourself a voice, and you're off. It's true, but you know it's true. I mean, who could ever replace Richard...
Harris.
Who?
Harris.
Yes, thank you. Richard Harris as Dumbledore. Well, the man died. They had to replace him. Does anyone realise now that it hasn't always been Mike Gambon? If I told you it was John Hurt in the Hobbit movie, and it wasn't me at all, you'd think for a second.
But that was unheard of at the time. I mean, you shot those three films all at the same time. I mean, I don't think anything had been done like that before. When he pitched that to Peter Jackson, you were like, I'm going to be going...
Well, it was a year's work.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of a stunner. Did I want to go and live in New Zealand for a year? Well, as it turned out, I was very happy that I did. I mean, I can't recommend New Zealand strongly enough. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. Quite unlike Western world. It's in the southern hemisphere and it's far, far away. And although they speak English, don't be fooled, they're not like us. They are. They're something better than us.
But it must have been nice for the two of you to revisit these characters in X-Men for the new one that's coming out.
I think it was, yeah. We are quite isolated in this movie. So
ooh, that's a very good word.
Thank you.
I was thinking more marginalized.
Yeah. That may be more realistic and pragmatic. But we were the first on the set. We shot for the first 4 weeks of what was to be a 5-month shoot.
God help them.
And they shot us out because we had other things to do, in fact. And I enjoyed it. I've always been a company man from the very beginning.
Yeah.
I wanted to work with groups of actors over a period of time. Well, Star Trek gave me that for 7 years of a TV series and another 6-7 years of 4 movies. And X-Men has it too. Only this time now, in addition to finding ourselves back in the company of Hugh and Halle and so forth, we now have a whole new group of actors too, who are playing our other selves or younger selves. I'm not giving away anything I'm not supposed to talk about, am I? No.
It all stays here.
But for us, this is really, we have to thank X-Men for the two of us really getting to know one another, because every day on an X-Men movie, you spend far more time sitting in your trailer than you do on the set doing a job of work. And those trailers are extremely luxurious. And we had adjoining ones, so we sat around and talked and reminisced, and I discovered a lot about this chap and he about me, and we found that there were many, many overlaps in our careers and many areas where we had little in common. And so we have Bryan Singer and Lauren Shuler-Donner, and Marvel Comics to thank for that. And Stan Lee, of course.
Yeah. You two are so part of pop culture. I mean, there are action figures, dolls, games, books, sheets, clothes. What is that like for you? Is it cool? Is it overwhelming?
I love it.
Yeah.
I was going to say I've always. It's intriguing to be part of the culture. But you can't take any credit for it. You know, it's X-Men that's part of the culture. It's Tolkien that's part of the culture. Mm. There were buttons, you know, Gandalf for president, before most of you here were born. I've arrived in Tolkien quite late in the day. The films follow on from the great success of the books, and the same with the comics and the X-Men films. But It just amuses me. It tickles me. I look in a shop window and say, "Oh, there I am." I can't take any credit for it. It wasn't my idea. I'd be made into a doll whose head did that.
And Patrick, for you.
Well, what happened to me was the shock of Star Trek, and I think it is now common knowledge, it's out there, that the only person who advised me not to do it is sitting on my left here, just a few days before I signed up. Actually, no, I was in the process of making the decision. I had 5 days to make up my mind. And that, like Lord of the Rings, Ian, changed my life. Every single corner of it has not been unaffected by that. No. The big surprise for me, the thing that occasionally makes me start and wonder if, as I say in both plays, am I asleep, is that my stage work should be where it is now. I never expected that to happen. And it has partly happened because of Star Trek. I launched Christmas Carol on Broadway. The first week, we sold the week to Star Trek fan clubs. And then the review came out and everything was fine. So I have my present theater career in part to thank to X-Men and to Star Trek. And that I get to spend 6 nights a week and 3 afternoons on stage with this chap is still... Because I was a fan.
You don't think of Sir Patrick Stewart as being lovable, do you? But I do.
He's lovable.
Maybe they do think of him. No.
They might want to make love to you, but that's different.
Well, on a personal note, I want to talk about your charity work because what you each do is tremendous. You have touched hundreds of thousands of people with what you do with your charity work. Ian, in 1988, you came out and become a role model for gay rights all around the world. You helped co-found the organization Stonewall. How has doing that and coming out changed your life and your career?
Totally. I've said it before, but it's quite a good line. On my gravestone, it'll say, "Here lies Gandalf, he came out." Well, anyone who here is gay will know. We have an extra responsibility in our lives, thrust on us by society. We have to... face the possibility of coming out. Straight people don't have that. It's the only advantage of being gay, is you have to come out. And in doing that, your life has changed entirely for the better. I've never met a gay person who didn't think that. But I was 49. 49.
Everybody who I'd ever met knew I was gay, with the exception of my stepmother and my sister, and other members of my blood family, who I never talked to about it, and the media, who had never asked me was I gay, and I'd never ventured the information. And everybody else knew, my friends, my employers, my employees. It wasn't an issue. Which is perhaps why I didn't get involved earlier in the gay rights movement. I mean, Stonewall, the riots here passed me by. I didn't read gay press. I didn't think there was an issue, because there wasn't really an issue for me. Except, of course, there was. I hadn't told my stepmother. Who, when I did come out to her, said, oh, Ian, I've known that for 30 years. but nevertheless, coming out at last means you are yourself. You can be yourself. And my acting changed overnight, I'm told. Didn't feel like that. But you see, up to that point, anything emotional in my life was a dangerous area. I couldn't hold hands with somebody I liked or loved. I couldn't be affectionate to them in public because that was against the law. Might be thought to cause offence to passers-by. It's the same as the new law just passed in Russia. If I were to hold hands with my beloved in Moscow and was spied by anyone under the age of 18, I could be put in prison for 10 years. It's a wicked world. Well, I grew up in such a world. I've lost track of what I was saying now.
How it's changed your career and your life.
Yes. And acting, of course, is much to do with your emotions and your inner life and how much you're going to reveal about them, which is why we all call each other darling and love. You've got to love the people you work with, otherwise you're never going to be able to strip yourself, as you're sometimes required to do in a rehearsal room, you know, risk making a fool of yourself. You can only do that in the company of people who are going to love you. So theatre was a good place for me to be, but I was still uncomfortable. And what happened when I came out, on the advice of Armistead Maupin, the author of Tales of the City, the millstone that I hadn't known was there fell. And the block that I hadn't known was there about the diaphragm dispersed. It's like a miracle healing from some evangelist. Ow! I see where there can be some truth in those theatrics. And when I said I was gay, I was confident. I was immediately happy. Many, many people thanked me. Some people wrote death threats, and I didn't mind, because I knew they were absolutely in the wrong. And I felt for the first time absolutely that I was in the right, because I was being myself. And the first part I took on, because I didn't want to start becoming a queer performer, which some people thought was required of me from now on, I should only play gay parts. I played in a movie of scandal about an English politician called John Profumo, about whom nothing is remembered except that he was a raging heterosexual. So I thought it would be a very good part for me to play, having just come out as being gay. I had to ask a friend how you did it. I'm an expert on the missionary position. And then I played Uncle Vanya for our beloved Sean Mathias at the National Theatre. And as the script requires, cried. Oh, I could do it now if I'm not careful. Couldn't do that until I came out.
Yeah.
That's why I know coming out's good for you. Mm. And being good for you, it's good for your friends, it's good for everyone you love, it's good for your family. Ooh, I hope I'm not offended anyone. And it's good for society as well.
Patrick, you have helped countless numbers of people with your involvement in domestic abuse protection, which is so important, through the organization Refuge and Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder through Combat Stress. What these two organizations have meant to you personally and how it's changed your life.
If I could just add my moment of coming out, because although much less significant than what Ian has been describing, which was fantastic to hear that, Ian, and for everybody. I started losing my hair when I was a teenager. And so I wore hats, caps, all the time. I always had my head covered up, but I also had an elaborate comb over. And there are photographs still floating around of this thing over my head. And I'd been at drama school with a wonderful, a Hungarian refugee from 1956 who was much older than the rest of us, George Kisfalvi. A few years after I'd been out in the professional theater, I went to have lunch with him and his wife. And after we'd had lunch, and I thought the two of them were in the kitchen getting coffee ready, I was sitting in my chair with the Sunday newspapers, and suddenly my arms were grabbed from behind. George was a black belt judo man. And he was pinning my, and I said, What are you up to? And then his wife appeared in front of me with a pair of shears. And I knew what she was going to do, and I screamed, and she lifted up my hand, she cut it off. And then George came around, never letting me go, came around in front of me and was gripping me, and he said, "No more hiding! You be yourself!" Mm. And it was a great, great thing he did.
Wow.
No more hiding. No more hiding. And that's what being on a stage means to me now as much as possible. No more hiding. My mother was a victim of domestic violence. My father was a remarkable and fine man, brilliant and brave soldier, but a weekend alcoholic. And at weekends, he lost control. So I saw, witnessed from the age of about 7, horrible things in my house. And I could do nothing except occasionally try and put my body between theirs, but nothing else for my mother. And I heard doctors and ambulance men say, who were called, and policemen, "Well, she must have done something to provoke him," she would say. My mother never did anything. And so when I was given an opportunity about 12 years ago to work for Refuge, which is the primary domestic violence charity in the UK and an extraordinary organization, I leapt at it because I saw here at long last was a chance to do something for my mother and those who are experiencing what she experienced. But out of all this, my father began to get publicly a worse and worse reputation, and I always began to feel slightly guilty about this, and I would talk about the other qualities in him. For instance, I have been channeling my father in my acting for years. And then on camera, 2 years ago, making a film for the BBC called Who Do You Think You Are?, where the subject is not told which of his ancestors they're going to be telling, discovering for him until the camera is rolling. So it's 2 weeks of discovery. It proved to be my father, not some distant ancestor. And sitting on some stone steps of a church above the Seine, one April afternoon, the man who was talking to me gave me a newspaper cutting and said, "Read this here," and it said, "Sergeant Alfred Stewart has returned home. He was in the British Expeditionary Force, calamitously defeated in 1941, who experienced horrendous things, but he was on the last boat out of Cherbourg, has returned home severely shell-shocked." So I read this on camera, and I'm reading information I never knew. Mm. We now call it PTSD. And when finally I got to talk to an expert on this, which we also did in the film, he said, "What you have told me about your father's drinking, the violence, his depressions, all of these are classic symptoms. And because it was 1941, he would never have had treatment. He would have probably been told, pull yourself together and act like a man. Nobody ever talked about it. He didn't talk about it. Your father went to his grave with PTSD. So I joined that organization as a patron. So now I do the same work for my father that I've been doing for my mother. And it makes me happy."
Well, we have to close out. We have kept these gentlemen much too long. But there's one audience question. There's someone in the house today. We have the original Maria from the original West Side Story here. We have Miss Carol Lauren sitting here, who is back in New York, starring in the new comedy, Handle with Care.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Carol, so much.
Her question was to both of the gentlemen, and her question was, will either of you marry me?
But he can't. He's married, but...
But you can't. And, I don't care.
There's one problem. I live in London.
My final question, gentlemen, for you is, what is the best bit of advice that you've been given that you still live by?
Principal of my drama school, Duncan Ross, who went on to become principal director at Seattle Rep in the Seattle school, said to me in my last months, called me to his office and gave me a serious talking to, but he ended up the interview with the following words: Patrick, you will never achieve success by insuring against failure. And it took me, well, until The Winter's Tale to work out what he meant by it.
What did he mean by it?
He meant, unless you risk everything recklessly, carelessly as an actor, not carelessly, but recklessly, certainly, and if you take the chance of exposing that which is most personal and private, then you might possibly be successful. Otherwise not.
Ian, for you.
Well, I didn't go to drama school, where I suppose you're given lots of good advice. My drama school, I suppose, was the first jobs I had, and the first theatre I worked in was in the Midlands in the UK, in Coventry, where there was a local repertory theatre financed by the Arts Council of Great Britain and the local authority, and we did a different play every 2 weeks in a custom-built theatre, first theatre built in the UK since the war. And the leading lady, Sheila Keith, and the leading man, Bernard Kilby, were both... They should have been working in the West End. They should have been in the putative National Theatre, which didn't exist at that time. They were very good actors. But they had, both of them in the past, not paid enough tax. And the crunch had come. You either pay so much a week on the nail, or you go to prison. So they were both holding down a job which they were too good for. Well, I got a bit of advice from both of them. My very first performance, I was in our production of Man for All Seasons. I was playing his son-in-law. And the man playing the King, Henry VIII, spied the ring I was wearing. I'd kept it on from Cambridge, I had some production. He said, could he borrow it? Because he didn't have a ring to wear as the King. So I said, fine. And he went on, and when he came off, I thought, I want my ring back, because I want to go on to the stage. Where is he? I couldn't find him. I couldn't find the ring. And I heard over the tunnel, Ian McKellen, you're off. I didn't know what that meant. Well, it meant I was off the stage, and I should be on the stage. And someone said, get down there. And I just raced down the stairs at the end of the scene that I should have been in, and all the actors were coming on, and effortlessly, of course, they'd covered for me and said all my lines, and the audience wouldn't have noticed any difference. Well, after my first performance ever as a professional actor, I was off. And Sheila Keith, wise bird, sat me down with half a pint of beer and said, Ian, every actor is off once in his career. Aren't you lucky to have got it over with so soon?
Fantastic.
Well, that was a bit of advice. It isn't the last time I've been off. But then Bernie, after the show, can you imagine? You rehearse from 10 in the morning till 6 at night. You do the show, and then you go home to learn. But there was always that magical hour or two when you could go to the pub. It was after hours, and it was closed up, and it was just the actors in there, and the police, of course, who dropped by. And I was always trying to buy Bernie a drink, because I adored him and admired him, and he was playing Thomas More in that production. He'd never let me buy him a drink. He said, Ian, I can afford to buy you a drink, and you can't really afford to buy me one. He said, but would you just drink it? And remember, when you can afford to buy the other actors a drink, will you do it for me? And 3 months later, we were doing an Agatha Christie play. It used to be called 10 Little Niggers, then it became 10 Little Indians, then it became, and then there was one, I think. Then there was one. Mm. And the characters died one by one, and he was playing the villain, and he had to fall over the sofa, and in doing that, during the show, he ruptured his inside, and next day died.
God.
Bernard Kilby. But he's still alive in me, because you'll find if you're ever in a company with me and you're younger than me, I'll be buying you a drink.
I'll hold you.
Well, on that note, I have done this for close to 25 years, and I want to tell you, gentlemen, thank you. This has been one of the most magical afternoons and one of the best interviews. Let's hear it. Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation, and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.